Now, live from deep in the bowels of the earth, home to woodchucks, snakes, and assorted critters, it's the Enviro Show on WXOJLP 103.3 FM, Valley Free Radio, Northampton.
That's great, it starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane, Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane, listen to yourself, churn world, serve its own needs, dummy, serve your own needs, beat it up, an ox, beat, grunt, no strength, the ladder starts to clatter with fear, fight down, high, wire in a fire, representing seven games, in a government for hire, in a combat site, let the western coming in a hurry with the furies breathing down your neck. Team, my team, reporters, babble, trump, tethered crop, look at that, no plane, fine, then, uh-oh, overflow, population, common food, but it'll do, save yourself, serve yourself, world, serve its own needs, listen to your heartbeat, dummy, with the rapture and the reverend and the right, right, you patriotic, patriotic, slam, fight, bright, light, feel it, pretty sight,
it's the end of the world as we know it, it's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine.
6 o'clock, TV hour, don't get caught in foreign tower, slice and burn, return, listen to yourself churn. Locking in, uniform and book, burning blood, letting every motive escalate, automotive incinerate, light a candle, light a motor, step down, watching heel, crush, crush, uh-oh, this means no fear, cavalier, renegade, steer clear, a tournament of lies. Offer me solutions, offer me alternatives, and I decline.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel fine.
Drifted by mountains, sitting in a line, Leonard Bernstein, Leonard Brasnap, Lenny Bruce and Lester Banks, birthday party, cheesecake, jelly bean, boom, symbiotic, patriotic, slam, button, nap, right?
Right. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel fine. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. And I feel fine.
Greetings, Earthlings. Happy Groundhog Day. We leave poor dazed Puxatawny Phil to his jailers and get the real story on woodchucks from Christine Mayer at the University of Southern Maine. Her primary research focuses on woodchuck behavior, groundhog behavior, and ecology. We'll also have a look at woodchucks being captured and used as lab experiments and the all-out war on woodchucks by suburbanites. Did we say Happy Groundhog Day?
Happy Groundhog Day.
How about Happy Imbolc? Yeah, it's the Festival of the Maiden. For from this day...
The Maiden Woodchuck?
No, the Maiden. You know, the Maiden.
Maiden Japan.
Goddess. From this day forward to March 21st, it's her season to prepare for growth and renewal. Bridget's snake emerges from the womb of Mother Earth. Not a woodchuck, a snake. From the womb of Mother Earth to test the weather. The origin of Groundhog Day. And in many places, the first crocuses flower begin spring forth from the frozen earth. Now you know. As always, we'll check out the latest news in the Enviro Show. Echo Chamber, Echo Chamber, Echo Chamber.
Hello.
And we'll check out Obama's record. And
Obama's record.
Meet the new boss segment and go for the quote of the week. But first, it's time for... Revenge of the Critters. What do you think? Groundhog attack!
It should be a groundhog.
This from MaineToday.com. Lewiston, a 240-pound military veteran, stands ready to dispute the notion that the cute, cuddly image of the groundhog in the movie Caddyshack...
Wait a minute.
That wasn't a groundhog.
I want you to go out and shoot all the golfers.
The golfers or the gophers?
The golfers!
James Nelson fought off rampaging groundhog in his backyard, but the critter kept coming back for more. After being kicked and hit with a shovel, it finally scurried away after a police officer showed up with a gun. The thing was bionic, said Nelson, who was twice knocked to the ground.
By a woodchuck?
Yes, it kept coming. It was like it was on a mission. The episode unfolded Sunday morning when the furry animal the size of a large cat showed up behind Nelson's home and proceeded to attack his two poodles as his 10-year-old daughter and her friend shrieked from the swimming pool. Wow. Nelson came to the rescue and shooed the groundhog away, but the angry critter came back. This time it attacked Nelson, hissing and baring its teeth. Nelson gave the animal a kick, and it ran away. But the groundhog came back, and Nelson whacked it on the head with a shovel. Nice, Nelson. It was like a bull, a matador thing, Nelson said. I beat up myself trying to fight it off. Cleo Dow watched the ongoing battle from the neighbor's lawn. He really wanted Jim, she said. When police officer Trent Murphy arrived, the groundhog was hiding under Nelson's garage. It was there that the groundhog launched its final attack, going after both men. I said, shoot it, Nelson said. Murphy pulled out his gun and fired. It was unknown whether the single bullet found its mark, but the animal disappeared into the woods to fight another day. Afterward, Nelson marveled at the tenacity of the animal, which he said was as aggressive can be. I'm not much scared of anything, he said. It was more like Stephen King version of Caddyshack.
No,
it was a gopher in Caddyshack. Get it right. All right.
I think the animal won, don't you?
I think so. Yeah. Maybe we'll hear from the animal.
What?
Let's hear what the groundhogs have to say about it.
That doesn't sound like a growl.
It doesn't sound like a groundhog.
That's a groundhog.
It's a groundhog. Yeah, it is. Because marmots,
I'm sure,
marmots have a very similar
I'm
call.
I'm sure it is.
It's a whistle. They whistle.
Yeah. Like
That's
marmots.
An alarm call.
And like prairie dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's a thing, the families, let's see, little correction. That was a gopher, right? From the family, Are We Ready? Geomaide. No, did I say that right?
I don't know.
Geomaide. Yes, groundhogs or woodchucks are from the family Suridae. No, Syridae.
We'll find out when we talk to the groundhog biologist later in the show.
Yes, that's right. She'll know. We'll ask Christine Mayer.
But, you know, I grew up on a farm, and on the farm there were woodchucks all over the place, and they lived in our basement some. And I never heard them make that noise.
What noise did you hear them make?
I don't remember, but it wasn't that.
They're generally quiet.
Yeah, they're very quiet.
That came from the National Geographic.
They make messes.
They can dig some pretty big holes.
They dig pretty big holes.
They can eat your garden.
Yeah, we had some a few years ago that lived under our hot tub and came out and ate my garden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, they can eat a lot.
Yeah, they're messy. They're messy animals.
Yeah, they can be up to 30 pounds.
Yeah.
And
these
they can
are
attack
big.
You.
I remember that they were really quite big. My people would eat them. They would shoot them and eat them. Yeah. Smelled terrible.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
You've got a lot of background with groundhogs.
I know.
Wow. Well, they knocked over the 250-pound guy, or 40-pound guy, right?
Yeah.
I think he's putting it on. I think he had too much.
I think it was probably just like that scene in Monty Python.
What happened?
You know, with the killer rabbit and the holy hand grenade.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was getting, you know, I had a choice of pictures to put up on the blog, and there was one with a groundhog with a bazooka on its shoulder. I thought of that one.
Yeah.
Anyway, it sounds like it would need a bazooka if it happened to live on your parents' farm back in the day.
Yeah.
Hey, moving on. Viral Show Echo Chamber. We rerun Grist's coverage of the RFK Jr. versus Don Blackenstick debate on mountaintop removal. Go to the blog. Check it out. It's really worth a watch. Just Google in the Viral Show. Click on the link. Finally, some good news. It looks like cap and trade may be kicked to the curb in the climate bill.
Yes.
Oh, really? I didn't hear this.
This is from the New York Times.
Oh, yeah.
January 27th.
Yeah, I read
headline,
that.
Advocates of climate bill scale down their goals. Congress' preferred approach, a cap and trade system to curb emissions of climate-changing gases, already faced a difficult road in a bruised and divided Senate. Bruised and divided Senate, yes. Bruised and divided Senate. But Obama, the one, came to make peace, the peacemaker. Its prospects grew dimmer after the special election in Massachusetts last week, won by Scott Brown, a Republican who repudiated the federal cap-and-trade proposal in his campaign, as he did Cape Wind, we might add.
Yes, indeed.
Republicans, industry executives, and some Democrats have already written cap-and-trade's obituary, at least for this year. And further down it says, realistically, the cap-and-trade bills in the House and the Senate are going nowhere, said Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, who is trying to fashion a bipartisan package on climate and energy measures. Quote, they're not business-friendly enough, and they don't lead to meaningful energy independence. Cap-and-trade isn't business-friendly enough.
Obviously, they're not talking about a carbon tax then, huh?
No.
That would not be business friendly, would
no,
it?
No, would not.
No. Enough.
All right.
Friendly
Since
enough.
Since when does business friendly, how come that's a requirement, something be business friendly?
Well, it all depends on who's buttering your bagel.
Yeah. And cap and trade.
Who owns the butter business?
Cap and trade would, if it went through, would be a whole windfall for...
Yeah.
For the corporados.
For Wall Street. And
For Wall Street.
You bet.
Indeed.
Yep. That's what it's all about.
But instead, they're going to build more nuclear plants.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
That's what they're doing.
Yeah. And biomass, maybe. Incinerators.
Incinerators and nuclear, the way to go.
Not if we can help it.
No.
Want to do the quote of the week?
Sure.
This is Alice Walker.
What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Stop. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going
on. And on our theme, our Groundhog Day theme, it has to do with critters.
Nice.
The animals of the world exist for their own reasons. They were not made for humans any more than black people were made for white or women created for men. Alice Walker.
Yeah.
All right.
But haven't you ever seen that the thing about what happens? You've got the monkeys, and then there's a picture. There's an outline of some kind of an old guy coming in, and a bigger, and finally
it stands
up. You know, it's a whole how we got where we are. We're the top of the food chain.
Yeah.
My students used to tell me that we're top of the food chain. We can eat whatever we want.
Ah,
that's it.
Yeah.
I used to find that very appalling, but...
What did you say to them when they said that?
Well, someday they're going to bite back. Like the guy, like the woodchuck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And aren't the lions higher on the food chain than we are? Lions and sharks?
No, because you know that picture. It's very common, showing how human beings have
advanced.
You start
with advanced. A fish,
and then you get up.
Yeah,
and on the top is Cro-Magnon man, whoever that is.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, who made the graph?
Well, yes.
Humans,
of
right?
Course,
well,
of course. Course.
Okay.
Of course.
All right.
You ever see an animal make a chart? Sheesh.
Oh, good point. Hey, time to meet the new boss.
Meet the new boss. Same as the old boss.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. In our new boss segment, we check out Obama's Enviro report card. This actually, he got two of them, but this is the one from the Center for Biological Diversity. Oh, let's see. Oh, well, let's see. He got a C in endangered species.
He
rescinded Bush-era rules weakening protection for endangered species. Oh, but what's this? He protected only two new species. He removed protections for gray wolves. He retained rules weakening protection for polar bear. How about oceans? They give him a B- in oceans. He took first steps towards addressing ocean acidification. That's a good thing. He'll
never get into graduate school with those grades.
He convened a high-level ocean policy task force to promote ocean protection. But what's this? Reduced protections for endangered sea turtles, allowed offshore oil drilling in Alaska. Let's move on to climate.
Okay, climate.
You got
better.
A C minus.
Oh, a C climate. Minus.
I'm sorry.
Oh man, the one is
on
not
the upside,
doing it.
He issued a seminal finding under the Clean Air Act that greenhouse gases endanger public health and welfare. He did new fuel economy standards. That's good. But what's that? On the downside, he failed to push Congress to enact legislation that has scientifically defensible emission targets and that retains Clean Air Act safety net. Let's move on.
Okay.
How about we take a look at energy?
Oh, yeah. It's got to be better, right?
Yeah, it's got to be some good stuff here. Yes, he announced oil and gas leasing reform. He withdrew oil and gas leases from the Arches National Park.
That was
a good move. Oh, what's that? He authorized mountaintop removal. What else? Let's move on. What's going on over there? Let's move on to public lands. Glenn, he got a B+ in public lands.
Excellent.
Did some good stuff.
Yeah.
He did good stuff with roadless areas. He withdrew the Western Oregon plan revision protecting old growth forest. He withdrew it. Is that supposed to be a good thing?
No, I don't know.
He proposed withdrawal of 1 million acres of land around the Grand Canyon from uranium mining. That's all good. Oh, but what's this? Authorized logging in roadless areas in Alaska. Continues to issue oil and gas and coal mining leases on sensitive public lands in the Western United States.
What about mountaintop removal?
Well, I told you.
He
got a C in energy, and that is for authorizing mountaintop removal.
Yeah.
But, hey, you know what?
Okay.
He aced a test in energy efficiency.
Yeah, oh yeah.
This from the New York Times. Obama puts government on low-carbon diet. President Obama ordered the government today to reduce energy use, cutting everything from the electricity used in office buildings to the petroleum used in fleet vehicles in an effort to slash greenhouse gas emissions 28% by 2020. Obama's emissions targets more than 3 months after he signed the executive order 13514, which required each federal agencies to submit a 2020 target for cutting emissions of carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping gases. The order also required federal agencies to conserve water, cut waste, support sustainable urban development, and use their buying power to promote the growth of environmentally responsible products and technologies. And further down says the cumulative effort will cut emissions by 88 million metric tons of energy use by about 646 trillion BTUs and energy costs by between 8 billion and 11 billion. The Obama administration. Uh-oh, what happened down here? Further on, it said the president's executive order includes an exception for the Defense Department. Sorry, no exceptions in our budget. Okay, finally, Sierra Club executive director Carl Pope. I thought he left Sierra Club, Carl Pope.
No, I don't think so.
He'll never leave.
Used the occasion to urge the Senate to pass legislation that would set economy-wide targets for cutting emissions and generating renewable energy. The House passed such a bill last summer. So there.
So he's not getting very far. He's not even an average student with those grades.
No, pretty disappointing for first year.
Oh. Yeah.
Hey, got somebody on the phone?
We're ready to start our interview.
Hey, good. Christine Mayer, are you there?
I am here.
Welcome to the Groundhog Day Enviro Show. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
How are things at the University of Southern Maine?
Oh, they're going pretty well. We're busy up here, and it's a little chilly, but things are going well.
Tell us what you do in relation to the woodchuck.
Okay, well, basically, I'm a behavioral ecologist, and what that means is that I study the behavior of wild animals in their natural environments to try to understand how their ecology shapes what they do behaviorally. And so what I've been doing since 1998 is following a population of woodchucks up here in southern Maine to essentially learn as much as I can about their social systems.
Wow.
Yeah, I got to ask you, Christine, do you have a great job or what?
Yeah. Well, most of the time it's a great job, but considering that the animals, as opposed to, you know, the animals in Pennsylvania, the woodchucks in Pennsylvania, my animals don't come up quite as early as them. But still, by the end of February, beginning of March, they're emerging above ground, and it can be a little cold doing field work in early March up here in Maine.
Yeah, yeah. So tell us about the social life of a woodchuck.
Yeah.
Okay, well, so the conventional wisdom before I started my work was that by and large woodchucks were solitary animals and very aggressive, and they basically didn't have anything to do with each other outside of the breeding season. So males and females didn't hang out together outside of the breeding season, and the juveniles left home in their first summer. So that was, like I said, kind of the conventional wisdom. But there were some hints that maybe they were more social than that. Some people had found that, well, maybe they didn't leave home as early as we thought and things like that. So I decided to investigate a little bit more. And that was the nice thing is that, so we essentially trapped as many animals in the population as we could, which was probably about 95% of the population we've been able to capture over the years. And we've just been following them over time. And what we found is that they actually have a much higher degree of social organization than what people had found previously. So, for example, in my population, about half of the juveniles don't leave home in that first summer. They actually will stick around in the area where they were born, and they'll hibernate in that area where they were born. And then in the next year, most of the males do leave. They'll go when they find their own territory to set up, but some of the females actually stay put. And so what you've got then over time is a group of females that are all related to each other living in the same general area. And so we see a mother, and she may have her daughters maybe even living in the same range as she lives in or next door to her. There may be aunts and nieces living next to each other. In some cases, the mother's sons live nearby. And so we have this kin structure that has formed in the population. And so they're essentially living next door to their kin. And in some cases, like I said, the kids never leave home. They stay put and they start breeding right either in the same place where they're born or right next door to the place where they're born. And then with what we also see is that they treat each other differently depending on on how closely related they are. So somehow, and we're not sure how this works yet, but we're going to have a graduate student that's going to be looking at that. They seem to be able to recognize kin, and they will treat more closely related animals more in a more friendly manner. So they have a higher rate of interactions that are friendly with those more closely related animals. But that changes depending on the age. So a mother may be treat her juvenile offspring more amicably, but as those females get older and are capable of reproducing, a mother starts to be a little bit more aggressive towards those offspring, and that's probably because now she's viewing them as a competitor, competing with her new offspring, and so there is some differences depending on age. So they actually have a much greater degree of sociality than we ever expected to see, really.
But it sounds like they have absentee fathers. You haven't mentioned the fathers at all.
Well, and that's true for most mammals. Father or a male breeds with a female, that's it. He's out of the story.
Mm-hmm. They're hanging out at the bar, usually.
That has an effect on the animal. So, you know, these guys are hibernators, and they have to start putting on fat as soon as possible. And so the males actually can get fatter earlier in the summer, because once they're done breeding, essentially they can devote all their energy towards putting on fat so they can get ready for the next hibernation season. But a female, on the other hand, if she's breeding, she has to go through all that process of gestation and nursing her young. And so she's got to get put on as much weight as he does, because there's no size difference, but she has to do it in a shorter period of time. And she does eventually catch up to a male.
How'd she do that?
She basically just spends a lot more time eating, probably. That's a good question that I haven't explored specifically, but what I would suspect then is that whereas a male, kind of later in the summer, he may just spend a little bit more time hanging out, not really moving around very much. A female will spend a lot more time feeding throughout the summer so that she can put on the fat she needs to survive.
Right. The groundhogs down here in Western Mass might even be more sociable than that, Christine. Jean's got a bunch of them that hang out in our hot tub.
underneath the place where the hot tub sits. And they came out, I mean, they had babies in there one summer. And just as
in the tub?
No, underneath in the porch. And when they came out, it was the first time I'd ever grown cauliflower, and the little heads were just, they came out and they just wiped it out. And people who were in my house said, oh, the cutest little animals came out. They're cute little animals. They ate everything to the ground, and it didn't take them but 2 days.
Yeah. Yes, and they're very good at doing that. It seems like the more that people like a particular crop, the more that the woodchucks also like that particular crop. Yeah.
So they have something like that. But gender relations generally are pretty disparate. In other words, the men go away. The boy children, most of them go away also?
Typically, yes.
Yeah.
However, like I said, there are a few cases where a male does settle very close or even within the same place where he was born.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we see is that essentially a female has a territory and a male has a territory. Now, a male and a female will tolerate somebody of the opposite sex in their territory, but they don't tolerate somebody of the same sex in their territory. So a female, if another female comes in, she'll typically chase that female away, and a male will do the same thing for a male, again, because they're probably being viewed as competitors for resources and for breeding opportunities within that home range or within that territory.
So here's my ecological question. What role do groundhogs, woodchucks play in like the larger ecosystem as far as, you know, are they a prey base for, you know, certain predators? Are they providing some key ecological function in a system? You know, what niche are they occupying?
Okay, so there's a couple major roles that they play. One is the fact that they burrow, and so they actually construct their own burrows, but a lot of other animals will use those burrows as well. So you'll find, sometimes you'll find skunks and rabbits, even foxes may enlarge them and use woodchuck's burrows. So, and then you will often find bees down in there and other insects as well that will use those burrows for
their
own.
And they dig down below the frost line when they do their burrows?
Yeah, the burrows go down about, up here at least, down about a meter. A little more than 3 feet deep because they have to, like you said, they have to get below the frost line. Mm.
But then they leave, the woodchucks leave the burrows after they hibernate and they come out and they leave?
Well,
all these other things go and live there?
Well, they don't leave because they still come back. Within an animal's territory, there's actually multiple burrow systems. Mm-hmm. So they don't spend all their time within one burrow system. But they use those burrows as refuges, and so they'll come above ground and they'll feed and they'll bask in the sun and things like that. But then they'll retreat to those burrows when danger threatens them or when to sleep and as well to hibernate. So the burrows are an integral part of what they do throughout their lives. And even though they're in that burrow, there's multiple chambers underneath the ground, not as complex as say a prairie dog's system or something like that, but there are some multiple chambers in there, and so other animals certainly can occupy those areas. It's not just a woodchuck, perhaps. And then the other major role that they play is what you had mentioned was as prey items, and certainly they're very important. The major predators on these guys are red foxes in particular and coyotes. But also red-tailed hawks. So this year at my study site, so one of the fascinating things about these guys is for as many years as I've been studying them, every single year is different. And so what we had this past summer was an immature red-tailed hawk that was very good at picking off juvenile woodchucks. Where I work is a wildlife sanctuary that's open to the public, and the hawk was not at all put off by all the people standing around and walking around, and it would just kind of swoop in and pick off juvenile woodchucks as well as chipmunks and gray squirrels and red squirrels and things like that. So the hawk was taking a lot of animals, and then there was a family of red foxes out there this year too. Mm-hmm. And they also ate a lot of juvenile woodchucks this year. So there weren't very many that survived to the end of the summer. But it was just one of those years, and we don't see that every year. Other years we have a really good survival rate or high survival rate. So
Jean was telling us before you got on that when she was a kid, they used to eat them themselves down on the farm. And have you ever had a roasted woodchuck?
I have not eaten my study animal this time. And I've heard again, it's like squirrel. You know, lots of people eat squirrels too, and essentially that's all they are very big squirrels. So and they eat grass and a little bit of grass, not so much, but clover and dandelions and things that you mm-hmm. think might actually make for somebody that
I hear they love alfalfa.
Yes, they do. They said they don't eat so much grass, but tomatoes, cauliflower, lettuce, coneflowers, that's what they ate at my house this year. Parsley, yeah.
Yeah. Well, what is their effect on the vegetation? I mean, do they contribute something to the vegetation, or do they destroy something that's necessary for all of the other beings to live on?
Yeah, for the most part, out in their natural habitat, they don't seem to really deplete the food resources that are out there. They're not eating enough to where the plants can't regrow. So essentially, they're acting like a cow in the fact that they're a grazer. So in a sense, their nibbling on food may actually stimulate additional growth in some cases, depending on the plants that you're looking at. But because it's usually only one animal in a particular area that it defines as its territory, they don't seem to deplete their resources that much.
So
then they certainly will contribute, nitrogen to the soil.
Right, right. But they don't eat insects or berries or nuts?
No, not really. It's all herbaceous kinds of foods. Yep. Hmm. A couple years ago, I saw them eating acorns
really?
For the first time, and that was unusual. I'd never seen that before. But for the most part, it's leaves stems.
Are they
stems.
Are they like squirrels and chipmunks that eat mushrooms?
Haven't seen them doing that.
Yeah.
No.
Because I've seen squirrels, and I'm not sure about chipmunks eating very poisonous mushrooms out in the woods. I mean, poisonous to humans, at least. And they seem to have no problem with them. They just nibble away on them.
Yeah, their metabolism may be such that they can break down the toxins better than people can.
Yeah.
I was falling all over my tongue trying to pronounce the name of the family that they're in with Chucks.
The Sciuridae?
Ah, Sciuridae.
Yep, so those are the squirrels. And essentially what they are just very big ground squirrels. So they're related to some of the ground squirrels that we see out west, as well as prairie dogs.
And
marmots.
That they are marmots. Essentially, what you can kind of think of them as being the eastern marmot.
The eastern marmot. Right. Yeah. And they go all through Maine up into Canada.
Yeah. So their range essentially extends across most of the eastern part of North America. Yeah. So they do go up into Canada, into Quebec, and then all the way down into South Carolina and Georgia, places like that. Not all the way far south, but like northern Georgia. Along that edge. And then they go west in the U.S. to about the Mississippi, and then that's about the border for them here. But in if you look at a range map in Canada, it actually extends all the way across Canada. And I have colleagues out in Manitoba, and they have woodchucks out there. And then there are woodchucks in Alaska as well. They're not high density, but they are some of them that live up there.
So in the east here, have they replaced something that used to be? I mean, there were at one point some larger mammals that were extirpated or whatever, mountain beaver and other things. Do you think that they've filled in some of those missing gaps?
No, the evidence suggests that they've actually always been around here. But one of the interesting puzzles that we don't know about is what their social organization may have been like. And so one of the things is that, 10,000 years ago, when most of the area here was forested, they may have actually been kind of confined into small pockets of habitat, because they're not really forest animals. They're edge animals, so they live on that border between meadows and woods, because they typically hibernate in the woods. But then they move out into the meadows to do most of their feeding during the summertime. And so they need to have a little bit of both types of habitat. And again, you know, before there were a lot of humans around, there probably wasn't a lot of that kind of habitat because of the woods growing. You know, you had some open areas when places burned, and for whatever reason, just you had meadows. But then when humans came, and so one of the things that some people have speculated on is that they may have been pretty social back then, because they were kind of forced into small areas of good habitat and living close to each other, so may have selected for animals that were more tolerant of each other and may have lived in bigger family groups. But then when Europeans came along and cleared most of this area, they actually kind of expanded the habitat for them tremendously, because we cleared the fields and made cow pastures and farmland and things like that, which was great habitat for them. And so that may have actually allowed the animals to expand and spread out from each other, and may have led to perhaps this idea of them being solitary and not very social animals, just because they could get spread further out from each other. But now if you think about what we're doing when we build shopping centers and subdivisions, and we kind of create islands of habitat again, where they have like my study site, which is essentially an island. It's a wildlife sanctuary that's surrounded by a subdivision, and you're kind of maybe constricting them into a smaller area again, and that may actually be forcing them to become more social, to be more tolerant of each other. So it's one of those things we can't test, because we can't go back in time, but we can look at populations that live in different types of habitat in more rural areas and more urban areas, and see if there are differences in their social organization.
Well, how about out west, where the marmots are? How do they tend to group up like that?
Yes, and that's the thing, is that most of the marmots live in alpine environments,
right.
So they're limited in the types of habitat they can occupy, at these small patches, and every other marmot species, really, except the woodchuck, is much more social than these guys are. Yellow-bellied marmots, which is a common species out west, has a pretty wide distribution. They are most like the woodchucks in that, you know, you don't see big family groups, but you will find females living with their daughters, and they are more social than the woodchucks are. But again, they're confined to smaller pockets of habitat.
Now, I've seen marmots in Colorado come right down by the roadside and seem to have no fear of humans. Is it the same with groundhogs?
Yep. It's certain areas. Well, again, my study site, which is open to the public, you know, if you stand in one place, and there's some of the animals are much more tolerant of people than others. If they're out feeding, you know, they'll come within a couple meters of you. Yeah. If you don't move or make any threatening actions towards them, then, you know, they get very habituated to people. And people see that in their yards all the time, right, with them coming up on the deck and, you know, and just, I guess some people have, you know, fed them by hand, which I don't encourage. But, you know, it's certainly certain animals seem to be very tolerant of people.
They got some pretty big teeth, right?
They do. They do. And yeah. When we trap them so that we can apply dye marks on their backs, we use hair dye, and we put a unique mark on each animal so we can recognize who it is from a distance, so we know each and every animal. And so as part of our trapping protocol, we wear heavy handling gloves that are lined with Kevlar material so that they keep our hands protected, and we're very careful to stay away from their teeth, yes.
Hmm. That would be smart. I wanted to know, to go back to this gender thing, do the male babies ever occupy areas that are close to their father?
Yes.
They do.
They do. It's not very often, but there are a couple cases. Now, we're not 100% sure who the fathers are. Because again, well, for one thing, when they breed, they mate underground. So we don't see those kinds of interactions. Huh. But what I have done over time is when I trap them to put on the dye marks, I also collect a hair sample, and I use that to look at DNA. Huh. And that's how I can tell some of these related relationships, and that's how I can also tell the fathers. And so in some cases, I have a pretty good idea who the father is, but in other cases, it's not quite clear who mm-hmm. the dad is. Mm-hmm. But there are cases where I'm pretty sure it's his son, and the fact that he's allowing that male to stick around also suggests that it's his son, because if it was somebody who's not related to him, we wouldn't expect him to be quite as tolerant of him. Mm-hmm. And so it's not very often that it happens, but there are a few cases when a son is living either is not completely overlapping with his father's territory, but there is a fair amount of overlap. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any patterns for migration when they lose their feeding ground or something and they migrate? Do you have any idea about what stirs them to migrate and how they migrate?
Well, we don't know that much about dispersal. Well, we know that some of these animals disperse, and so over the years I've put radio transmitters in some of them so we can tell where they go and when. And so, you know, some of them leave in that first, well, some of them disappear in that first summer, let me say that. We don't know if they die or if they've actually dispersed. But with certainly the ones with the transmitters in them, some of them have dispersed, and it the patterns vary. Some of them, they don't always go in one particular direction. But what's amazing is that, and I don't know if they're following scent trails or how they're finding, because they, you know, they have to have a burrow. That's their place of refuge. That's how they escape from predators, and that's where they sleep at night because they don't, you know, make a nest in a tree or anything like a gray squirrel will. And so there's still a lot that we don't know about how they can find those new burrow systems. But they obviously do, because we track them to places where they're in a burrow. But in terms of, and it could be that, you know, they take these little journeys out, and like I said, we don't know if they're following scent trails or how they're deciding which direction to go or things like that.
Christine, while I was doing research for this show and I stumbled on your webpage, I also ran across many references to woodchucks being used for lab studies on hepatitis B and hepatitis D in humans and stuff. And there was even one outfit that goes out and does wild-caught woodchucks. Wild-caught woodchucks are by far the most utilized animals to assess the initial efficiency of a new anti-HBV compound. compound is usually more cost-effective to use wild-caught animals, as these are more available and less expensive than captive-born. And this outfit also sells captive-born woodchucks for these lab experiments. Can I ask your opinion of that kind of business?
Well, certainly I understand the need to use animal models for human medicine. And, you know, essentially, and I know of, I mean, Cornell University, for example, has a huge colony of woodchucks that they use for hepatitis B research. Yeah, it's amazing. But the woodchuck is kind of the model organism for developing vaccines in Hep B and Hep B studies and looking at liver cancer and things like that. So for whatever reason, their metabolism and their physiology is such that they make really good study animals for that, and so we can learn a lot about human health by studying, you know, their biology. You know, essentially, in some areas, these animals are extremely common, and they can reproduce, you know, 4, 5, 6, well, I think my record is 7 offspring in a year. But they only reproduce once a year. And so chances are, you know, if they could be captured at a sustainable rate in a certain area, as long as, you know, people aren't going out and capturing too many of them at one time, the population probably could handle some of that.
Is there pretty much an open season on groundhogs hunting wise?
Yeah, I think they're actually in many places considered varmints, and so people don't. There aren't any laws necessarily protecting them.
Yeah,
and in some ways, you know, that status makes it handy for doing research on them, because you know, in terms of not having to get a lot of permits and things like that, it makes it much easier as a researcher to go out and observe them and trap them enough to do what we need to do with them. But and like I said, when I tell people that what I study, many of them kind of roll their eyes and think I'm crazy because they just see them as pests.
Well, have you always wanted to do this ever since you were a little person?
No, well, I never would have imagined that I would study woodchucks until I moved to Maine and took up my position at the University of Southern Maine. Before that, I knew I was always interested in animals, and as a kid, I thought I wanted to be a vet until I actually went and worked in a vet's clinic and realized that I would have to run a business, and I had no desire to run a business. So I crossed vet off my list, veterinarian off my list, and when I went to college, I got a job in a research lab and helped a professor do his experiments in population genetics, and I thought, wow, this is great, and then I realized that you can make a living doing research and working in a university, and so that kind of set me off on a path. And I had two favorite subjects as a college student. One was animal behavior and one was physiology, so I decided to study behavior.
So now, once a year, along about February, people like us come knocking on your door.
Yep, that's pretty much the way it works, yes. I usually get one or two calls around this time of the year from people, which is nice. It, you know, I tell my colleagues that, you know, I'm probably the only person, people that study woodchucks, which there aren't very many of us, you know, we're the only ones that actually have a holiday for our study animals. So
yeah. Were you out there today checking on your...
I was out there a couple weeks ago, and I did not see any signs of activity. And considering how cold it's been here lately, I don't expect them to be out yet. I think
sleeping.
The earliest I've ever seen signs that an animal had emerged was on around February 15th. And that's unusual. It's typically more towards the end of February up here. Mm-hmm. But down where you guys are, you know, I know in Pennsylvania, not, you know, counting Punxsutawney Phil, but wild woodchucks in Pennsylvania are certainly out and about this time of the year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, that's where I grew up in Pennsylvania. And in the spring, you began to see the rabbits running around and then the woodchucks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's... And then the birds started coming back. It was all part of the same thing.
Yeah,
so
I've been hearing chickadees singing lately, so that's
a
good sign.
We're having a problem with chickadees. Chickadees in this area have got some kind of... one of the biologists told me she thought it was a fungal thing.
Oh, really?
But I haven't. And my bird feeders, I've had very, very few chickadees.
Us as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, happy Groundhog Day.
Thank you, and same to you.
Christine Mayer, and if people want to learn more about woodchucks, groundhogs, where should they go?
Well, probably the easiest place, there's kind of a website called the Marmot Burrow, and so if they just look that up, and that has information about all kinds of marmots, not just woodchucks. But it sounds like, you know, they could also check for woodchucks on the website and apparently find some information there, because you that was successful for you.
Great. Yeah. And I promise I won't ask you how much wood a woodchuck chucks. If a woodchuck
I knew somebody's going to bring that up.
Thanks, but you know there is an answer to
oh,
that.
Oh, there is? Okay.
Yes, a woodchuck would chuck all the wood he could chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood.
Yes.
Well, there you
yes.
go. Yes. Thank you, Christine.
Thank you very much. It's
You're
been
very
nice
welcome.
Talking with you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take
Bye.
Care. Christine Mayer up there in the mm-hmm. University yeah. of Maine, Southern Maine.
Hey, we're going to listen to a song off of Tom's new CD. It's titled Biomass, the CD. And we're going to listen to cut number 6, which is 5 Tons an Acre, which is about the use of farmland to grow corn and high fructose corn syrup. So
great.
Okay.
All right. Next, in 2 weeks, we'll be back with Derek Jensen.
And this is Glenn Ayer saying see you next time.
This is Dio saying bye.
And this is Gene Grossold saying protect the woodchucks.
Happy Groundhog Day.
Happy Groundhog Day.
You got corn in your hair, corn in your nails, corn in your carbon. You got corn in your entrails to give you diabetes or clog your arteries with a burger made of fat, fast food industries. I grow 5 tons an acre of corn I can eat, 200 bushels for a high fructose treat. And so does liquid candy, and your pancreas can deal with adverse metabolizing, and your system doesn't heal. Cause when blood sugar's gone kafooey, there ain't no going back. Your cholesterol is rising for another heart attack from my 5 tons an acre of corn that we can't eat. Cause we want our meat and sugar to be fast and to be cheap. Now cows are made to feed on grass, a millennium old tradition. And walk around that be locked down in feedlot extradition. Corn fed gives 9 times the fat that I say obesity. How many millions could we feed if we could only eat my 5 tons an acre on this Iowa farm? But we want our meat and sugar no matter what the harm. 6 months force feeding corn is gonna kill us dear. So they go 5 months and change before they disappear. You see, their stomachs have a surge. Sounds like something in Iraq. But cows die from acidosis, not some black water attack. Yeah, they change their name to Z to cover up their reputation. But they're still high killers to get oil from a nation. But let's get back to corn. And it's not about nutrition. Did I say diabetes? This fat sugar composition from my 5 tons an acre of food that we can eat. Cause we want our meat and sugar to be fast and to be cheap. And it's not about the food, it's the money you can get from 5 tons an acre of food that can't be yet.
And you're listening to Valley Free Radio, 103.3 FM. And we're going to listen to a few more cuts off of Tom Nielsen's new CD, Biomass. So this song is about the battle to keep Nestle off of the Montague Plains aquifer.
There's trouble out on the Montague Plains, another of Nestle's pollution campaigns. 150 million gallons a year. Don't worry about people, the corn and the deer. 13 gallons for a penny when you turn on the tap, or $2 a liter in a convenience trap. Millions in promo to promote the scam of water not safer than the tap in your hand. Dasani is Coke, Aquafina is Pepsi. Pure life in Poland are hustled by Nestle. Reverse osmosis, ozonation crap. You get a better drink when you turn on the tap. Arsenic, mercury, bromate are found from water in bottles, but not from the ground. And saying that water in bottles tastes better is like saying that water in bottles is wetter. Aquafina is Pepsi, Dasani is Coke. Nestle taking our water's no joke. Millions of dollars for a corporate lie to rip off the people and bleed the land dry. Now 20 million gallons a year of oil to make bottles of plastic appear. Then off to the landfill they disappear, or our roadside attractions with old cans of beer. So Montague neighbors we met and agreed that Nestle's is not what Montague needs. But Governor Patrick is winking his eye, 'cause he's a good old Coca-Cola guy. Aquafina is Pepsi, Dasani is Coke. Nestle taking our water's no joke. Arsenic, bromate, we don't need that crap. Yeah, the water is better when you turn on the tap. Oh, the water is better when you turn on the tap.